All right, welcome to our Sunday evening Building Zion conference call. If you're new to the call, I'll just briefly introduce what we're doing. Each week we've been sharing some of the 500-plus quotes that I found dug up in old conference talks from the 1850s through the 1880s by LDS apostles and prophets in regards to building or establishing Zion. And I needed them as backup, as support, teaching high priest group Sunday lessons. And I had some intimidating people in the group, and so I knew I had to be able to substantiate anything I said about building Zion now. And so I've been amazed as I've categorized and subcategorized these quotes. I've been amazed at the things that I've learned that we never talk about in Sunday school, which I find disconcerting because Christ can't return according to Moses 7 until we build Zion, and
yep.
We don't seem to be doing much. We, the members, don't seem to be doing much in that direction.
Right.
So tonight's topic, this subcategory. In fact, the further we get into this, the fewer quotes in each subcategory. This one is called Building Zion Requires Real Labor. And there were, about 20 quotes that fell into this category. And I've searched a little bit to find a few more, but I found a couple more and haven't spent much time looking for this category because, to me, it's blatantly obvious and I don't need much more support on it. Okay. Crisis averted. Okay, where were we? So, these fell into 4 subcategories. And the first one is Building Zion Requires Physical Labor. And these span from 1855 all the way to 2001. I found an L. Tom Perry quote.
Wow.
So this first one, let me read it. It's Brigham Young, 1855. In fact, the first two are from that year. For if we are to build up the kingdom of God or establish Zion upon the earth, we have to labor with our hands, plan with our minds, and devise ways and means to accomplish that object. So it's not a passive, let's wait for Jesus to build it program. It's a we have to do it program. That same year, at October conference, everything connected with building up Zion requires actual severe labor. It is nonsense to talk about building up any kingdom except by labor. It requires labor of every part of our organization, whether it be mental, physical, or spiritual. And that is the only way to build up the kingdom of God. Then let's see. So it wasn't just Brigham. Heber C. Kimball, 1863. As members of the body of Christ, we are called upon to labor and to do our part towards building up his kingdom and should all have equal interest in that kingdom. We manifest our attachment to the principles of progress and improvement, both of which are intimately connected with the building up of Zion, when we plant orchards and vineyards, and when we make good gardens, good farms, and when we build good houses, in doing all of which we get a liberal reward as we go along. Then let us stretch forth our hands and build up towns and cities of Zion. So you can see this, the pattern here is that they're saying this building Zion is a real activity that we do with our arms and hands. Let's see. Then the L. Tom Perry quote I ran across. I typically focus on the older ones because the interest in building Zion communities pretty much died after the raids in the 1880s. And so it's not that common to find quotes along that line more recently, but here's one from L. Tom Perry in 2001. The prophet And in fact, if you listen to the phraseology, he doesn't use the word Zion. He doesn't use the words United Order. But listen to what the words he chooses, and you hear those words echoing in the background. The prophet had a design to build a community of saints. He had three major objectives. First, economic. Second, educational. And third, spiritual. Notice spiritual didn't come first. The second basic principle is that of work. Work is just as important to the success of the Lord's economic plan as the commandment to love our neighbor. Very few people I know that I've talked with, at least very often, even understand that the Lord has an economic plan for us. Most people just assume that we're engaged in the world's economic plan, and some way magically Zion is going to erupt from that. Okay, so the next subcategory is the converts that they were teaching and who were immigrating. Some of them misunderstood what was going on here in Utah. We talked 4 weeks ago about how the apostles and prophets were actively building Zion in Utah, in the Utah territory. And so this comment shows that real labor is required, and some of the converts misunderstood that point. And the best quote showing that is from Apostle Jedediah Grant in 1854. "Do not think that you will be without your trials here, singing glory to God and that is all you have to do. I have often said to the English brethren and sisters that were I in England, I would tell them the first things that they might expect to meet in Zion, specifically to leap into the mire and help fill up a mud hole, to make adobes with their sleeves rolled up and be spattered with clay from head to foot, and that some would be set to ditching in Zion, to making ditch fence ankle deep in mire, and that they might expect to eat their bread by the sweat of their brow as in their native country." So there apparently had Brigham Young mentioned in the previous year, and then 6 years later, how some of the saints were showing up thinking, "Where's this sign you guys taught us about?" And the point was, you're here to build it. Ready, go. Jump in. Help us. And apparently they misunderstood that was what the program was. They thought they were going to live free and easy for the rest of their lives. The next subcategory, among all the quotes I gathered, there were only two that said this, and that is that the Lord isn't going to build Zion for us. And both are from Brigham Young. I'll read the first one. It's the clearest. "The Lord has done his share of the work. He has surrounded us with the elements containing wheat, meat, flax, wool, silk, fruit, and everything with which to build up, beautify, and glorify the Zion of the last days. And it is our business to mold these elements to our wants and necessities, according to the knowledge we have now and the wisdom we can obtain from the heavens through our faithfulness. In this way will the Lord bring again Zion upon the earth, and in no other." So, sorry folks, Harry Potter isn't going to show up and wave his wand and poof, we have Zion. We're going to have to actually build it. So, let's see, the last subcategory. I hope that's not disappointing to y'all.
I think we're going to live through it.
The last subcategory, this is my favorite. In fact, I'm going to read my favorite quote of all time from Wilford Woodruff, and then I'll tell you what the category is. Okay, ready? We have it to do. We can't build up Zion sitting on a hemlock slab, singing ourselves away to everlasting bliss. We have to cultivate the earth, to take the rocks and elements out of the mountains and rear temples to the Most High God. We are doing that. And this temporal work is demanded at our hands by the God of heaven. This is the great dispensation in which the Zion of God must be built up, and we as Latter-day Saints have it to build. People think it strange because so much is said with regard to this. We are obliged to build cities, towns, villages, and we are obliged to gather the people from every nation under heaven to the Zion of God, that they may be taught in the ways of the Lord. So I labeled this subcategory, we can't talk or sing Zion into existence. I got bored and I have to admit, I got bored in church once. And
not,
so
not
I
you.
Opened up, what?
Not
really?
You.
You?
So I opened up my scriptures, or my hymn, the hymn book, and started logging how many of the hymns talked about Zion.
Lots.
And half of the first 10 do, and then I lost count. I can't remember, but there were a bunch of them. Mm-hmm. And but the sad part is, singing about Zion isn't going to make it happen. So here's a couple more quotes. Brigham Young, 1855. You know the old theory is that the kingdom of God and all pertaining to it is spiritual and not temporal. That is the traditional notion of our brother Christians. But a person may merely think until he goes down to the grave, and he will never be the means of saving one soul, not even his own, unless he adds physical labor to his thinking. He must think and pray and preach and toil and labor with mind and body in order to build up Zion in the last days. I think that makes it pretty clear. And then 7 years later, in 1862, we talk and read about Zion. We contemplate upon it. And in our imaginations, we reach forth to grasp something that is transcendent in heavenly beauty, excellency, and glory. But while contemplating the future greatness of Zion, do we realize that we are the pioneers of that future greatness and glory? Do we realize that if we enjoy a Zion in time or in eternity, we must make it for ourselves? That all who have a Zion in the eternities of the gods organized, framed, consolidated, and perfected it themselves, and consequently are entitled to enjoy it. There's a whole conversation in that quote. Then the last one is another Wilford Woodruff, 1873. We are not called to build up Zion by preaching, singing, and praying alone. We have to perform hard labor of bone and sinew, in building towns, cities, villages, and we have to continue to do this. And we should have the Spirit of God to direct us then as much as when preaching, praying, singing, and attending to the ordinances of the house of God. If we do this as a people, we shall grow in the favor and power of God. We should be united together. It is our duty to be so. Yeah, that quote by Brigham Young, that last one I read by his, that all who have a Zion in the eternities of the gods, organized, framed, and perfected it themselves, and consequently are entitled to enjoy it. That's not something we really talk about. We don't say in the church, hey, if you want to participate in the Latter-day Zion, you have to help build it. Ready, go.
Yep.
It's more like
we're
waiting.
Well, let's talk about some ways we can build it then.
Oh, gosh. You always want to do that.
Uh-huh, I do.
Okay. So, Next week, the quotes I wanted to read are about what's holding us back. And there weren't very many in that category. A lot of them fit in the one we talked about 2 weeks ago, is what's required of us to build Zion. And but the week after that, in a couple weeks, assuming we don't miss because of Thanksgiving, the subcategory is Building Zion includes achieving economic independence from Babylon. And there's quote after quote after quote talking about that. So, Joyce, when you ask the question, what can we do individually to prepare for Zion, to me, that answers the question. Achieve economic independence from Babylon as much as we can.
Yeah.
On an individual basis.
Yeah.
And which is a nice lead in to Mark.
And what is Mark doing today?
Well, I'll tell you a story. About a couple of years ago, I decided I wanted to see if I was ready, because I've kind of been prepping for a better part of 16, 17 years. So I just decided,
wow.
Okay, the call just happened or the economy just crashed, and I got to load up my truck and go. What am I going to take? So I went to my storage unit, backed up my truck, loaded it to the max, and then I looked back at my storage unit and just went, crap, look, I still got plenty of stuff to take. And it's like, so then I went and bought a top for the back of my truck, and then I scheduled another one. What's that?
So you could pile it higher.
Yeah. So I said go again and went to storage and loaded it all up, all the way to the top, all the way to the front and back, including the cab and everything. Looked in my storage unit and went, I still got more. But I ended up buying a trailer. And so set up another third time. It's like, okay, here I go. And then I load up my truck, including the top and the trailer, look at my storage unit, and I still got too much stuff. So I end up buying a top for my trailer. And so,
maybe,
and then,
Mark, yeah. I'm just wondering, is the problem that you have too much stuff?
Well, in many ways, I think we all, you know, we all do. And there will come a point where we're going to have to let a lot of stuff go, or most stuff go, or everything go.
Mm.
So, you know, and I did it a fourth time, and, you know, I still have a lot of stuff. So, you know, even all my food storage, all doesn't even fit. So, you know, even if I just took that and didn't take pots or pans or candles or any lanterns or anything else. So one lesson I learned is, you know, no matter how much you think you're prepared, unless you've actually loaded your van and tried to see what's going to go and what's not going to go and what's going to fit, what's not going to fit, we're all just kind of shooting in the dark. And so a good labor practice would be to just say, you know, just do a pretend, okay, we just got called out and I got to go and I got 2 hours to load, ready, set, go, and then to see, you know, and obviously it's not going to be successful. But you're kind of hoping to fail so that you can see the mistakes you made, the stuff that you brought too much of, the things that you forgot. And so, you know, to then take your life and reprioritize, you know, what you should take and what shouldn't you take. And if you have more room, what can go and what can't go. So that's one of the life lessons that I got out of it.
That's great.
Cool.
Yeah.
We probably ought to, for anybody who might be listening that isn't aware of what a call-out is, we probably ought to review that. I counted them at one point. I think I counted 12 times in the Book of Mormon where either God called his followers to leave the current society, or they were driven out by wicked government. Seems like there were 12 when I counted.
Counting the ones in the Bible either.
No, and it? There's plenty there. I just, that book's so long, I didn't want to read it. Anyway, so the idea is that before the saints are prepared to meet Christ and usher in, as he ushers in his reign, that the patterns will probably hold. And so that's what Mark's referring to when he talks about a call out, is the idea that the Lord, through his prophet, would say, let's take those who are willing to go and prepare to meet the Savior. Let's take them out away. Which really fits into, gosh, that meeting today just really got me. I've been in bishopric meetings or ward council meetings, well, bishopric and ward council meetings, and then today in our ward teacher council, where people were complaining about, you know, how bad things are. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, this is Babylon.
Yeah.
Do you want to keep staying here? I mean, you know, we complain about how bad things are, and especially the negative influences on our kids in the church. We complain about that, and yet we stay in Babylon.
Yep.
As if we, and in fact, somebody sitting next to me said, yeah, we can't do anything about it. And I'm thinking, what? yes, we can. We don't have to live in Babylon. We don't have to stay.
That's right. Sell that TV.
Yeah.
Oh, don't tempt me. I would just so love to get rid of that. I would have a very unhappy husband on my hands who wanted to watch the sports.
And I would say sell the couch. Let the home teacher sit on food storage boxes.
No, if you do that, they'll just bring you another couch. They will, I promise.
Yes, I know.
I know. Oh, that's funny. That's great.
Yep.
So what about you, Joyce? What's your latest preparing for Zion activity?
I tend to be rather spacey and go flitting hither and yon, you know, and not finishing any one thing. But I started making a rocket stove. My brother on this call, he bought me tin snips for Christmas because before Christmas, I was complaining how I would love to start making rocket stoves, but I didn't have anything to cut the metal with. So, of course, he buys me tin snips for Christmas.
What a thoughtful brother you have.
Yes. Isn't he wonderful?
That's love.
I know. And so I bought the materials. I bought perlite, and I saved my cans, and I started making the rocket stove. And then, of course, I get sidetracked on all these other wonderful things that I do. And I collect rags because I don't think that we're going to be able to make a heck of a lot of paper. I mean, we can to a point, but we may not be able to make as much as we use now, especially like toilet paper and stuff. So I have quite a supply of rags. Here's the thing, Mark, as you've noticed, you just cannot take it all with you.
Yep.
And there's a saying about, you know, you can't take it with you. Well, it makes me wonder what we are going to be able to take. And as you said, maybe we're going to have to pare down and just have a lot of knowledge in our heads about, just for instance, learning what edible plants grow naturally in the environment, and instead of bringing a bunch of books to help us identify these plants, maybe we need to hurry up and learn those things so we don't have to carry the books with us, that sort of thing.
Yep, and organize a nature walk where somebody can teach each other, these are all edible plants, here's how to collect them, here's, we're going to walk through nature and you find 15 of these or 20 of these.
Right, and you teach them how to use the plants, all the different things that the plants can be used for, and how to use them. So, that's just one example of paring down. So we carry it in our heads instead of in our cars.
Right.
Huh. Dang, that means I have to do more studying.
I know. And when to find the time.
Andrea can't be on the call today. Her child is sick and crying. So send our prayers towards her. But she and I have been talking about, and it's mentioned on the Zion Society Facebook page, have been talking about starting a marketing co-op like Lorenzo Snow did in Brigham City. And we're looking at different products and things, and I don't know who knows this, but I have an Amazon, I'm a professional Amazon retailer. So I sell stuff on Amazon. And I've been toying with the idea of a lot of people like me who do what I do could benefit from having service organization do the repackaging of products. Half the products, in fact, more than half of the products I order from distributors and then ship to Amazon have to be repackaged and or labeled. And so I've had the thought for a while that maybe setting up a cooperative like Lorenzo Snow did for Brigham City and just start small, start creating an economic engine that could eventually fund the creation of an actual brick-and-mortar community.
Something else we both could do just is to create an online, you know, online presence. And, you know, I'm real good at getting sites ranked for search terms. So.
Well, that's right. You do that, don't you?
Yep.
Yeah. So anyway, she's looking into what it specifically takes to create a cooperative. I used to have a manual, and I looked all over. I must have thrown it out in a fit of despair once when I was despairing for Zion.
Oh, dear.
And and so, anyway, she volunteered to try to track something down that explains how to create a co-op legally as a legal entity. And so the way that works, and this is outlined fairly well on the website. It's under best practices, I think. No. Yeah. It's talking, but the best practices page basically saying, okay, Jess, so you talk about building Zion, but how would you do it right now? And so it's my 1, 2, 3, 4, 5-step plan on how to get started. Well, step two is to create a virtual cooperative selling products produced by members. And that's what Lorenzo Snow did. And Brigham Young complimented him once and said, you know, Brother Snow has gotten the people of Brigham City into a united order without them even knowing it. And he did it by creating a central marketing cooperative. And then the profits from that cooperative went to setting up other people in business who then sold their products through the cooperative. And so by the time they were done, well, by the time it got shut down by the U.S. government, they had achieved what one scholar estimated 85% self-sufficiency. So they were producing 85% of all the consumer goods they were using.
Wow.
Which is amazing. Yeah.
We would have trouble getting to the point where we could produce iPhones for everyone, but but at least we could start on things that they did. For example, they had, you know, they made hats and belts and shoes and of course we don't need. Well, I suppose. Well, anyway, so that's the idea, and so that's what I've been talking with Andrea about, and moving in that direction. So that's what I've been doing the last week. Besides planning my solar greenhouse that I want to build in my backyard. That's been fun.
That is cool.
That you're going to bring with you, right?
No. It's for until then. Yeah, you remember President Kimball said, was it Kimball? Who said there'll come a day when the only food we have to eat is what we can produce ourselves.
All right.
And so I've kind of been trying to move in that direction. So this solar greenhouse is a step in that direction. I was going to build it underground. I was fascinated with the idea of underground greenhouses. They're called
Wallapini.
Yeah. And I kept looking at my plan and kept thinking, the sun can't reach those plants on the north wall, or let's see,
right,
south wall.
You have to build everything south facing.
Yeah, and so I kept toying with the design, and finally I ran across a video on YouTube that said the principles behind a Wallapini can be applied above ground, and here's how. And I thought, oh, okay, see, that solves the problems of that the Wallapini creates. They work great in closer to the equator.
Right.
Yeah.
But the further
north
you go, the less effective they are.
I don't know. I disagree. I taught a lady 3 years ago all about Wallapinis, and she actually dug one. And in February, it's minus 50 in Alaska, and she can walk into her Wallapini and pull out lettuce in the middle of February.
Sweet.
That's
awesome.
In a Wallapini, it's always 50 to 70 degrees.
Yeah.
I mean,
so,
if you ever go in one, if you go into a Wallapini, you'll go, why doesn't everybody have one of these? Why doesn't every family in the United States not have one of these? Because you can grow stuff 365 days a year. Doesn't matter about rain, doesn't matter about snow, doesn't matter about heat, because, you know, it's the same as even true if you buried something. If you buried something a foot deep or 2 feet deep, and then go dig it back up 3 months later, 8 months later, and feel the temperature of what it was you buried in there. And you're going to find out it's not freezing and it's not hot.
Yeah.
But it always keeps everything in there between 50 to 70 degrees.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's been my fun activities this week.
Well, you want me to talk about canning butter?
Sure.
Sure. Tell us how to can butter.
Okay, well,
why
basically,
would you want to?
What's that?
Talk about why you would want to in the first place. I mean,
you
can
want
always just go to the store and buy it, right?
Yeah. But there's going to come a day where we won't have stores. Mm. So if you've got a cow or goats, you know, you can take their milk and then turn it into butter. And then to can butter, you know, so, you know, I'll buy, you know, I usually do somewhere between 30 to 80 pounds at a time. And so I'll buy the butter. I usually wait till somebody's having a sale, like Smith's. They'll sell them for $2 a pound. And in fact, they're doing that right now. In fact, you can go to smiths.com and get on their online coupon, and you'll see a coupon on there where they're selling them for $1.99. Mm. And so it sends it to my card. My Smith's card, and then I walk in there and I just punch in my number or slide my card, and then they'll see it and they'll go, okay, it's $1.99. So if you want 10 of them, it's $20. And so then I bring them home. I just get a stock pot and I throw, you know, I kind of do them in batches. So like tonight I broke it down into three batches because I had bought 15 pounds of butter today. So I've just got three batches. I melt it, and then I've got a ladle, and I just get canning jars. So I like half pints. The first time I did it, I did pints, and so then I kind of realized, wow, these are much bigger than I thought. So, you know, since then I've just done them all in half pints, which I like better. And so you fill up the jars, a half pint, you got to leave a half an inch of headroom. And, you know, trust me on that, because if you don't, when you're going to put them in the oven later, they'll boil over, and now you're going to have
a cookie sheet or
something full of butter because you didn't leave enough headroom. So leave a half inch of headroom at the top of each jar, and then put the lid on. I'm going to call it not even hand tight. Hand tight is too tight. And so, you know, I just put the lid on, you know, and turn it with my one hand holding the jar and spinning it, and that's it. And it's like you didn't even get it half tight. I know that. And but just trust me, this is how you do it. And then you're going to put however many as you want on a cookie sheet. For me, I do 12 jars at a time because, you know, that's how they come from the store, the jars in 12. So put all 12 on a cookie sheet. Then put them in the oven. Now, you don't want your oven hot. You know, I would tell you to put it at, 210, max 220. You don't want it, don't put it, if your lowest setting's 250, it's going to struggle. You may want to open your oven doors to let some of the heat out. Because you want it only 210, max 220, but water, water boils at 212. So, if you didn't leave enough headroom in the jar, it's all going to bubble up and boil out, and not only do you lose butter, but now your whole cookie sheet's going to be just chuck full of butter. And then just put them in the oven. I put them in there for 30 or 40 minutes. Realize if you got to make a mistake. It's better to make a mistake to leave it in there a hair longer. It's not gonna. Oh, it's all gonna evaporate or it's all gonna boil over. It won't. And so, because it's gonna get to almost to a boiling point anyways, because your oven's at 210, 220, and then once it's been in there 30 to 40 minutes, I just take them out, and then I just set the cookie sheet on top of the stove. And then I usually use a couple of dish rags, one for each hand, and then I'll hold the jars, and then I'll put them on, a little bit more than hand tight, the lids. And but then they'll start popping because they're going to start sealing, and usually within 5 minutes max, absolute max 10, they've all popped. And then I can take those jars and put them back in a box, and then do the next batch of 5 pounds.
Nice.
So you're gonna have to store an awful lot of popcorn to go with all that butter.
Well, my wife loves popcorn, so yeah, we have popcorn in our food storage.
Mm-hmm.
So when you melt it, you said at the beginning you melt it. I assume that's on a low heat. Isn't butter, I don't know anything about butter. Can you overcook it?
Yeah, you can. You technically can, but, just like I melt it on a low setting, it takes a little while, and I check it, I'll leave it on the stove and go check it once every 5 minutes for, 15 minutes, and usually then it all melts. So stirring it helps. When I first put the cubes in there, as soon as I have enough for a ladle, I'll grab a ladle full and douse the tops of all the butters, because that helps it melt
right.
A lot faster.
Gosh, I never thought about canning butter. Do you happen to know how long it's supposed to last in that condition?
Oh, 5 years.
Really?
So I'm still living on jars that I canned 5 years ago.
Huh.
So from my experience, it doesn't go bad. And people putting expiration dates on stuff, I think, is a little overrated. And they say, it's good. You can do that for 5 years, which means you can probably it's probably good for 10. But it's kind of like jelly or jam, butter. I put in the same category. You're going to take the lid off and you're going to know, you can tell, you'll smell it, and if the butter's bad, you'll know, just like jam or jelly. If you just leave the jelly sitting on the counter, a week or two later, we'll take the lid off, it's going to not smell right. And so, but butter will last you 5 years. So, you can always just can enough to last you 1 year. And then, especially if you're canning butter every year. So I kind of just do it whenever there's a sale. So, and I'll do, 30 to 80 pounds at a time. So, it's kind of been a joke because we had high priests and had high priest presidency came over and they said, they sit down the whole presidency and said, so what are you canning this week? Because I'm just a huge canner and dehydrator. I own 9 dehydrators. And,
oh, my gosh. And I said,
at that time we were doing jam. And I said, you guys want some blueberry jam, strawberry jam, or peach jam? And so I gave them all a bottle of each. And then they said, oh, yeah, the whole ward's already talked about it. When the crash happens, we're all just coming to your house for some butter. So one of the sisters asked me to teach her, so I taught her, and then she ended up teaching her Relief Society homemaking lesson on it. So it's really not hard.
We need to come up with a comeback for that comment, because it's like, well,
yeah.
shouldn't you be doing it too?
I won't be here. That's a pretty good one. Or
I won't.
Well, but then you have to explain. You have to go into, you know, what you plan on doing instead of being there, you know, and you might say, well, think about what you'd be willing to trade for the butter, you know, everybody needs to think about preparation, and I realize they don't, even though I'm not the ward preparation specialist, you know, I will still put deals I find online or locally, you know, I will put them on our neighborhood Facebook page, which we have. And also, I found out that the ward preparation specialist is not allowed to do that.
Yeah.
Apparently, because it's just too much pressure on people.
I thought it was because people to make money off ward.
Oh, geez.
Preparedness specialist or something.
Well, I didn't hear that. I just heard that, you know, the one we have or used to have anyway. She told me that she wasn't allowed to do that because it puts big guilt trips on people, you know, and it's like, oh, come on, guilt can be useful. It can be very useful.
Our ward prep lady, she put something in the program literally every Sunday and every month, you know, whatever it is this month, it's in there for those four Sundays. Next month, it's a new topic, and she's, you know, so she's always pitching, you know, save water or, you know, mm-hmm. or, you know, mm-hmm. how are you going to start a fire and, you know.
Well, I tell you one thing I did. There was a prep fair, I guess you could call it. Last August, we attended a prep fair, and we bought 5 gallons of a laundry detergent concentrate, and it cost us $35, which is unheard of, you know, for a quarter of a cup per load. And for the three adults that 5 gallon has been serving, it's lasted over a year. And so I went to go buy some more from them. Turns out, apparently, they couldn't make a go of it, and they sold their company to another company that doesn't really care. And so they've got a couple of pallets of this detergent and no plans to make more or even actively sell it. When I contacted them, they said, oh, you know, the new employee said, oh, do we sell detergent? And so I went and bought 3 of the 5-gallon barrels and sold one to my neighbor at cost, you know. But just things like that, we really need to collect things that will help us get through the coming hard times, if we have to bug in or bug out, either one, you know.
Right.
Cool.
Everybody should learn how to can. Everybody should learn how to dehydrate.
Mm-hmm. And grow their own food.
And learn how to grow raisins. We made our own raisins this fall. That was fun. So we've got a couple of boxes of homemade raisins in our pantry.
We made our own grape juice and our own grape jam.
Yeah.
One year, the neighbors were out of town for an extended period, and she totally forgot about her grapes on her vines. And so she calls me and says, will you please go and pick all the grapes that you can use? Well, I went over there, and most of them were already raisins. But I picked them anyway, you know, and just, oh, it was wonderful. They were yummy. So that's one way to make raisins, is just leave them there.
Yep.
Mark, have you made raisins before? I was going to ask you if you have.
Yeah, yeah. And I was a youth. We lived in Northern California, and we used to go work the church farm up by Fresno, and they had tons, and they had acres and acres of grapes, and we would go cut them all down, and they'd lay out paper, and we'd lay them on paper, and then literally they would just leave them. We're like, you're not going to take these? It's like, no, we'll come back in 2 weeks when they're raisins, and then we'll just pick them up then.
Huh.
Yeah.
I did.
And that's literally what the church does.
I use my dehydrator, and they get kind of sticky during the process.
Yeah.
So they're hard, you know, they're hard to get off the tray, and they stick to each other all over the place.
Well,
and,
if you do.
I wondered if there was a.
Yeah, if you do them on paper, then you can throw the paper away, you know, or even recycle it if you want to shred it and bury it or whatever. But, that was fun. That's fun to make raisins, especially let nature make them.
Yeah.
You ever thought about making a list of everybody's talents and skills so that
Among us in the Zion Society group?
Yeah, uh-huh.
That's probably a good idea.
Yep.
Of course, your list is going to be longer than everybody's, so.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well,
I have a lot of seeds, that's for sure.
One of the reasons I really like the idea of Lorenzo Snow's approach with Brigham City is the... where was I going? Is it getting late already? is the idea that... Oh, that's what it was. We're all participants in Babylon's economy. But it's fickle. You know, that economy is on a shaky foundation and could easily fall over. It seems wise to me to all have a backup career. I hate to call it a career, but a backup that we can do in that kind of a setting that would bring value to our fellow man. And when I read the Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope, it's about the history of the modern civilizations since the late 1800s. As I was reading that book, it talked about how, you know, the different phases of different countries becoming dominant in the world and how they can't do that unless they can feed their armies, and they can't feed their armies unless they have some kind of agricultural breakthrough.
Right.
And it occurred to me reading that the only reason I can afford not to be a farmer is because there are people who are farmers who are willing and able to sell their goods in the market economy.
Right.
If they ever become unwilling or unable, then I have to either be a farmer or die.
Yep.
I choose being a farmer. So my backup career is essentially farming. And I'm blessed to have an acre of land. But I've been watching some YouTube videos lately. YouTube is such a great resource.
Yep.
There's a guy, I think he's in California, but I'm not sure where he is, actually, but he makes $100,000 per one-third acre of land that he doesn't even own farming, and he sells the produce to the local restaurants and grocery stores.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, I'm not even producing on my 1 acre enough food for my own wife and I. I need to kick in and do a little bit more. But anyway, so if that guy can make $100,000 a year on a third of an acre, I think we can all figure out how to produce our own food pretty much. And I think the people who do are those who will, generally speaking, those who will be around to participate in building the official Zion Society when that time comes.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I told my stake president, I love the guy. He's really great. He's a very loving and caring person. He's a good leader. His focus for our stake is, you know, let's build Zion. And of course, he takes it from a spiritual perspective, which is important and valid. So I was visiting with him once. I pitched the idea, back when there was severe unemployment, I pitched the idea of creating one of John Taylor's Zion Central Board of Trade to solve our local unemployment problem. And in the conversation, I said, you know, President, you can't build Zion with dead people. if there's a big natural disaster, if that earthquake that we expect here along the Wasatch Front ever hits, or the terrorists take out the power grid, or who knows what, solar flares take out the power grid for months, you know, we're going to lose 98% of our population in the United States. And so the people who can produce food are going to be those left over to be able to participate in building a better world. Yeah. So that's why I'm a farmer part-time. And I see that as specifically enabling me to participate in building Zion communities either before or after. We need to be economically independent as well, or at least capable of sustaining ourselves. And if everybody, I mean, think about this, in the ancient Jewish state, everyone had land, and that land would revert, if you, through your carelessness, lost it, it would revert to your family every 50 years. So if everyone has land and everyone can produce their own food, that kind of society is extremely stable and enduring. And Babylon is the opposite of that. We're all very dependent on the system for our daily sustenance.
Well, yeah. The farmers who, lived through the Depression, they had children, and the children grew up, and they said, we didn't know there was a Depression. We always had food. We had, our needs taken care of. We weren't rich, but we didn't even know there was a Depression.
Yeah, our own stepmother remembers as a child her parents beating vagrants who would jump off the railroad tracks and come to their farm, and they'd give them work and feed them, and they had a huge farming operation and were able to bless a lot of people's lives that way during the height of the Depression.
Yep.
So let's do that. Ready,
let's
go.
Let's do that. Ready, go.
We're going to have to be semi-organized because, we can't have 200 families showing up and 200 men saying, well, what do you want me to do? Cut firewood?
Right.
Because we don't need 200 guys cutting firewood and nobody fishing and, nobody hunting and nobody gardening.
Yeah. And we could learn a big lesson from when the saints arrived in the Salt Lake Valley. They were acting like one giant family, which is, I believe, what a Zion economy is. And they divided up the chores. And they had a hunting committee and a fishing committee and a log cutting committee. It would be nice to kind of at least have...
And everybody gets to rotate, so everybody can learn the fine art of fishing. Everybody can learn the fine art of hunting and fine art of...
Well, the fishing committee fell through because there wasn't much to catch, apparently. but anyway,
Utah Lake used to be chock full of fish.
Yeah. It makes sense to me that...
they caught them all.
That planning this kind of thing out ahead of time makes so much more sense. I tried to pitch to my high priest group that you know, if the big earthquake comes and fires are started, the city, I can't remember the name of the city in Japan, it's a couple hundred thousand people, a big earthquake came, it started fires, half the homes in the city were destroyed because there was no the water lines broke, so the firemen had no water to put the fires out. And I was trying to make the point, look, we need to be prepared ahead of time. Once the disaster hits, it's too late to prepare. You need to already have your backup water supply in place.
Yep.
And I felt like it was falling on deaf ears. Wish I had that charisma thing, you know, that I could be a little more persuasive. But anyway, we can do what we can do.
That's right.
All right. So, well, let's keep up the conversation on the Zion Society Facebook page, and we'll invite our listeners to join us there as well. And I'll post as soon as this audio is available. I'll post it on the website under Sunday Conference Calls. And we'll see everybody next week. Thanks,
okay.
Mark and Joyce.
You bet.
Have a good one.
Have a good night. We'll see you next week.
Yeah, next week in Zion. Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.